The race is on to vaccinate the nation against the coronavirus. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Maryland, 1.6 million residents have been fully vaccinated, or nearly 28% of the state population. Nationally, around 84 million have been fully vaccinated, or approximately 25% of the population. There are some major obstacles ahead. A severe clotting disorder has forced a pause in the Johnson & Johnson vaccine approval, while there has been a serious resistance to getting vaccinated among certain segments of the population. I want to take a look at the issues with Dr. Mike Murphy. He's an emergency room physician at Tidal Health Peninsula. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So let's turn to this issue about blood clots. Johnson & Johnson, I think there's been something like six initial cases anyway in New England. Looks like AstraZeneca might have some issues there. What does that mean, particularly for those of us who are looking at getting vaccinated?
Well, I think we have to put it in perspective. It's six out of 7.8 million vaccines. Very low number. Everyone who had the blood clotting issue was a woman under the age of 60. So patients that are still sort of under the influence of estrogen, I guess, would be the nice way to say that. And it's an extremely rare development. You know, they called it a pause. They really didn't take the vaccine off the market because they're verifying, is this happening more than it would happen in the general population? And, you know, if you do the numbers on it, it's really not happening more in vaccinated patients than in the general population, the occurrence of these very specific type of blood clots that they saw. I would caution people, particularly, look, if you're a man, if you're over the age of 60 and a woman, and you're looking to get a shot, the Johnson & Johnson should be safe and effective. You know, with that being said, they did have an issue with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine even before this happened, where they had to take a number of their vaccines off the market because of an issue they had at their factory in Baltimore. So I think we're still leaning more towards the Moderna and the Pfizers anyway, at least in the state of Maryland. But, you know, with the blood clotting issue, you know, if you're a woman between the ages of 16 and 60, you have about a 1 in a million chance of perhaps developing this blood clot issue. If you develop COVID, you have a much greater chance of having serious side effects from the infection itself. And so I think the vaccines are still safe and effective.
Yeah, matter of fact, I think with COVID, you've seen some blood clots, as it were, from that disease itself.
That's correct. Now, roughly 19% of patients who get COVID will develop blood clots of some nature, whether it's in the legs or the lungs. And so you're absolutely right. The incidence of the blood clots in patients who are infected is much higher than the 1 in a million we're seeing in the vaccination group.
So in terms of vaccination hesitancy, some people have pointed obviously to, I guess, Republican men, I guess, in terms of polling and not getting the vaccine, that kind of thing. What are you seeing in terms of this hesitancy? I mean, in fact, I ran into one nurse at a local physician here who said she wasn't going to get the vaccine, not just because other people, for instance, might be better to get it than she, but she was clearly skeptical about it. What about this hesitancy that we're looking at here?
I think it's hard to explain from my standpoint. I mean, if you look at the science of the vaccine, it's very safe and it's very effective. I think you're always going to have some skepticism in the community, and that will lead to hesitancy in terms of people's willingness to embrace, scientific breakthroughs. I can tell you that I know of a few nurses that I've worked with. Their biggest concern was they're of childbearing age, and they just weren't sure about the safety of the vaccine for childbearing age. And the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists tells us, hey, it's much worse, again, if you get COVID than any potential side effect that you could have from the vaccine. So I think the hesitancy, as you mentioned, there have been a lot of studies that come out that folks that were more likely to vote for President Trump are less likely to get the vaccine, which to me, it's a little ironic. I mean, he's the guy who helped develop it. I mean, the vaccine was developed under President Trump. He fought to make sure that it was done quickly. He wanted to have it done as soon as possible. And he himself and his family have made it very clear that they were vaccinated and done so publicly. So it's odd that that's the group that's choosing to be hesitant about the vaccine given those facts. But there is a little bit more hesitancy in that group. And then I think you have a set of people that are more distrusting of science and the medical community in general, and they'll be difficult to convince to get the vaccine.
Okay, so one of the things that's really struck me is that we have this vaccine, and yet we have certainly some political leaders who have been skeptical. We have some commentators, for instance, on Fox, who have expressed skepticism about this vaccine, to say nothing about, obviously, the earlier questions about the actual virus itself. I mean, this is a very strange time where you have some political leadership saying, no, we don't, we're skeptical about it, we have a problem with it. And then you have obviously another group of people who are saying, no, you should go ahead and get vaccinated. You have obviously Anthony Fauci, for example. I mean, the society seems to be getting these cross messages in terms of whether or not you should get it or not. I mean, this is, and I think back to to 1918 when they didn't have anything at all. And in that particular case, they actually tried to keep it under the radar, as it were, with the newspapers. But here you just get these conflicting messages back and forth.
Well, and so the hard part for me again is, the message of, I guess probably the best way to say it is, people are seeing sort of the messy side of practicing medicine. It's not always a straight line in terms of the facts that we're able to ascertain and our ability to understand how a disease process works. And so, people sort of come after Dr. Fauci because of what they consider being inconsistencies in what he said. And realistically, everything that he said is scientific-based. We just, as we've learned more about the disease, certain facts have changed. Certain things that we thought were accurate a year ago are not necessarily accurate today. And that's part of dealing with a new disease process. And the conflicting messages is an unfortunate side effect, I think, of the polarization of our society at this point. I think, anytime people are going to take their scientific and medical cues from pundits and politicians, we're going to have a problem. People really need to dig into the science and listen to what physicians have to say about it, I think, as opposed to sort of listening to talking heads.
In terms, by the way, of hospitalizations, have you seen this go down? I mean, what kind of progress have we been seeing, and particularly progress in terms of actually even treating the disease, even if somebody gets it?
Well, the treatment has come a very long way from when we started a little more than a year ago. We are on the shore. Our number of cases have blipped up a little bit here in the last week or two, but we still have a much lower rate of hospitalization and death than we did just a few months ago. So we've made great strides, I think. Combination of our knowledge in terms of how to treat the disease, the tremendous success in the vaccination of particularly the older community who is more susceptible to the disease, people's knowledge about social distancing and those things that help us keep the disease in check.
In terms of that, I mean, we have this rollout, obviously, of the vaccine, and there were lots of people, mm-hmm. I can remember trying to hunt around myself, from computer screen to computer screen, trying to find it, right? Well, now we've got a whole bunch of vaccine that's available, but we've seen now kind of a roll-off in terms of a lot of appointments are now going unfilled, as it were. What do you make of that drop? Do you think that's a natural thing that might occur, or is there something else going on here?
I guess I'm not. Is that happening in Salisbury at the walk-in center?
I don't know whether or not your folks, at Title Health have experienced that, but I know nationwide, I think West Virginia, Alabama, for example, they've all seen some serious drop-offs. I mean, they were at one point, there was like 90%. Now they dropped down to like 70% in terms of filling out those appointments.
It's interesting. I think, again, it goes back to you have some. There's some natural progression. I mean, as you talk about 200 million total doses are given, at some point the supply will outstrip the demand because everybody's going to be vaccinated or everybody who's going to get vaccinated will be vaccinated. So there's probably some natural progression there. But then again, I think some of it has to do with this vaccine hesitancy that we talked about a few minutes ago, that you have some people that are just not going to do it. And maybe a family member signed them up, or maybe they signed themselves up and changed their mind, or something just came up and they didn't make it. But I think it's probably a combination of things. And certainly part of it has to be attributed to the fact that, you know, we're over 200 million vaccines in. At some point, we're going to run out of arms to put vaccines in.
But also, by in terms of the hospital you certainly work in, what kind of restrictions are there now, and how has that changed over time? I know that, for instance, Title Health, I guess, you can now have at least one visitor. Before, they didn't allow them. What's that been like working in that environment?
Well, it was, I will tell you, it was when there were no visitors, it was very challenging. These patients were by themselves, frequently very old, and not always necessarily able to tell us their full history or give us a good explanation of what was going on that brought them to the hospital. And it was very difficult, I think, for a lot of staff when this was really at the height of the pandemic and there were no visitors allowed and people were dying from COVID and they were dying alone. And so it was very challenging, I think, for the medical staff to have to witness that and to be the only people sort of present when these folks, if they died of COVID, when they died. And even, like I said, just being able to have visitors, have people have some contact with the outside world while they were in the hospital, it was a hard thing for patients especially. And it made our jobs a lot more difficult as well. And so currently at the emergency department at Title Health Peninsula, you're allowed to have a visitor downstairs, and you can have a visitor upstairs. I think it's for 4 or 6 hours a day. And so I think that's made things a little bit back to normal. It's hard. We still have to sort of keep the numbers down because you don't want to have large gatherings. But visitors are allowed again on a sort of restricted basis, and I think that's better for everybody.
What kind of emotional toll then does it take on the staff when you have these kinds of restrictions? I mean, even now, obviously, you got restrictions, but and you guys, mm-hmm. you guys have been in this thing for I guess now over a year, and you know, for a lot of us, you know, we sort of sit there, watch the TV, and hope we, you know, put on our masks and hope we don't get it, and maybe we don't go out to the restaurant. But you guys are like in the middle of this thing.
Yeah, and it was. Last year was very challenging. It was very difficult. It's what we all trained for, and it was all the reason that we do what we do. And my hat was really off to all the inpatient physicians at PRMC, you know, led by the lung specialist, the pulmonologist, the intensivist, the hospital team, Dr. Chris Snyder. I mean, we really were very lucky on the shore. They were really at the forefront of treatment and recognition of the right way to take care of these patients. And we really hasn't been terribly well publicized, but had a hand in some of the decisions that were made nationwide in terms of how to treat the sickest of the sick. And so that was very rewarding to work with those guys. But the difficulty when the outbreak first came and you saw people of all ages really coming in and there were a lot of people dying that it was almost inexplicable why they were dying. And that's hard. I mean, anytime your patient dies as a physician, a nurse, any type of healthcare provider, that's very difficult. And it's something that you take personally. And so it was from March to about July, August of 2020 was a very rough and dark period, I think, with a very nice light at the end of the tunnel as we really started to understand the treatment of COVID and how to make sure we had more people surviving. But it was challenging last year. It was a very challenging time.
Because I know I talked to actually a couple of nurses at Title Health, and they obviously talked about their own experience. But then, you know, they would be on shifts for a long period of time, but then they would have to come home, and obviously then they have to deal with loved ones that they live with. I think one nurse I talked to, they actually with her husband, and they basically lived in separate parts of the house, as it were. I mean, was that a common thing? I mean, how much concern were people, you know, being in the middle of this and then being out with other people? The potential
for
this
spread. Didn't know it, you know, we didn't really know at the time how contagious it was. And, you know, so anytime when I came home from the hospital, I undressed in the garage and went straight to the shower and didn't have contact with anybody until I'd scrubbed myself from top to bottom, just because we didn't know. And I still sort of do that, I'm still very careful in terms of what I do after work and the contact I have, and I don't bring anything home from the hospital. And, you know, we found recently, I mean, the CDC has sort of recently said that now, hey, this really isn't spread on surfaces. This isn't spread through clothing. It isn't spread through, you know, if you both touch a book, the book isn't going to transmit COVID, so you don't have to worry about it as much. But, you know, we didn't know that at the time. And so, yeah, people were, they were being exceedingly careful because, you know, when you see, you know, everybody talks about, hey, this was a disease of the old, this, the elderly are at the highest risk. We still would see a 40-year-old, you know, strapping young man who died of COVID. And that's, that can scare you. You see that, and you know that that's a very much of an outlying situation, but you don't want to become that outlying situation. And so, yeah, you, I think people, I heard of people quarantining themselves if they were working, having, they wouldn't hug their children. They minimized physical contact, made sure they stayed 6 feet away from people. I didn't go to quite that extreme, but I was, and I think a lot of my partners were very careful about decontaminating, I guess, is about the best way I could think of when we got home to sort of minimize spread.
By the way, did you have a personal experience with COVID?
I did. I did contract COVID in November.
And what was that like? I mean, what was your experience
with it?
I was
pretty lucky. My biggest symptom was really just fatigue. I'd had a bit of a sore throat and some mild cold symptoms. I never had a fever. I never had a cough or any trouble breathing. But for about a week, it was tough to get off the couch. And so just very intense fatigue, and came through it just fine. I haven't really had any side effects, but it took a while to really fully recover.
Because I know that a lot of people do, when they, if they contract this, they do have long-term side effects. But I guess there's a new term called long haulers. And that seems to be an issue that I guess the medical profession is going to have to begin to try to deal with beyond just the initial getting the disease.
Yeah, that, there are, I don't have an exact percentage, but there are people who have symptoms for months, you know, 3 to 6 months, and even people that are, you know, at this point, we're about a year out, there are people that are still having side effects from infections last spring.
So are you then optimistic about where we're going here? I mean, obviously we have the vaccines. I think I mentioned a moment ago, we got about 25% of the population that's been vaccinated. We'll see how far along that goes. And how does that, do you think, relate in terms of getting to herd immunity?
Well, I think that we will accelerate, hopefully. I mean, if you sort of see the number of vaccines going in arms every day, I think we'll get close to that 70% number probably in the next 6 to 8 weeks. And then, yeah, I'm optimistic. I think once we sort of start to achieve those types of numbers, things will start to open up some more, and we'll see, you know, where we go from there. I mean, I have to try to be optimistic about it. We also have to be a little bit realistic. I mean, there's a possibility that if another variant shows up, we may have another bit of a surge, but at least I think we have a pretty good handle in terms of how to treat patients, and they're already working on vaccine variants and boosters, you know, for those possibilities.
How serious is this issue of variants? Obviously, the idea is that if this thing mutates, it might mutate into something that our vaccines might not be as effective. Although I was reading the other day that some of the vaccines we have actually been fairly effective. What do we know about that?
We do know the B117, which is the one out of South Africa. The current vaccines are effective towards that one, and that's the one that's been the most aggressive in Europe. There will always be variants, and I think we talked about this before, that, you know, it's just a fact of dealing with viruses that we shift and they shift. We make immunologic advances and they make changes in themselves that are advantageous to you know, continued propagation. And so it's something we'll have to consider. It's why, you know, it's why we change the flu shot every year. You have these changes in the antigens on the vaccines, and so it's certainly a possibility. But I think, you know, in terms of the way we are dealing with COVID, the current vaccines are effective towards the predominant variants that we're currently seeing. And I think scientists they have a good handle in terms of making the vaccine for COVID, and even if a variant comes up, we should be able to do it pretty rapidly.
And as I understand it, that some of the techniques that they're being used, particularly for these vaccines, that some of them based on technology or ideas, as it were, that have already existed in terms of new ways to attack these kinds of viruses.
I mean, are you referring to like the mRNA virus?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, this was the first mRNA virus, and certainly something that's been proposed and researched for a long time. It's one of the reasons they were able to do it so rapidly. It's not something that was invented within the last year. I mean, it's been known to the scientific community for a long time. And that ability to take just a snippet of the virus itself, as opposed to the whole virus, just the part that would let your immune system recognize it and kill the whole thing, that's a big deal. That's one of the issues, I think, with the AstraZeneca and the Johnson & Johnson is that they sort of did things the old way, where they used sort of a killed virus to introduce a bit of the COVID vaccine in, and that's why I think we're seeing more side effects from those and fewer side effects from the mRNA vaccines.
So in some ways, is this particular virus, one gets the sense that it has advanced our knowledge exponentially in terms, or accelerated our abilities then to be thinking about, obviously, not just simply this virus in terms of combating it, but perhaps it has given us some ways of combating future viruses, as it were.
I think that's accurate. And I think it's one of these things where, you know, immunologists and virologists have sort of always been studying these kinds of things, and it's just come more into the public eye in terms of what their research and capabilities have been. I would agree that it's sort of made it more mainstream to have that understanding.
So when we look at the future, is the coronavirus, do you think, going to be with us then for a long time to come?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, the funny thing about the coronavirus, it's always been there. We've seen it in multiple forms forever. It generally in the past has just caused a bit of a cold, like cold symptoms. This one mutated to a point that it's just more aggressive and caused more serious illness. And so, yeah, it's not going to go away. It's just a matter of making it so that it can't spread or cause serious illness.
I mean, do you think that we're going to be sort of looking at this like we do with the annual flu shot kind of thing?
If I had to guess, I would guess yes.
Yeah, yeah. By the way, and I just got through talking to somebody actually at Blue Cross Blue Shield, that this virus is also revealed, maybe in stark contrast, the disparity, as it were, when it comes to healthcare, obviously African Americans have had higher rates of mortality, higher rates of getting this thing, as opposed to, say, whites. Do you think we've learned anything about that in terms of trying to get a handle on this disparity that we obviously have been living with for quite some time, and we're sort of aware of it, but this, as one someone put it, sort of put a real spotlight on this problem?
Well, I can only hope that that's the case. You know, when we work in the emergency department, we see the patients that have difficulty getting into physicians' offices or having regular care. I mean, they show up in the emergency department for a reason. And so I've seen this for 20 years, and it's been something that we've been trying to improve for 20 years. And I can only hope that the spotlight that is shining on the racial disparities in medicine can be sort of accentuated, and we can learn from it and try to come up with solutions to sort of improve that disparity.
By the way, we did see when it got rolled out here in Maryland, I suppose, and elsewhere, it got to sort of a bit of a rocky start, as it were, in terms of vaccination.
Initially, I think one of the issues we had, we weren't getting as much vaccine as we wanted to use. I mean, I think Maryland was one of the states that was very eager. We had a number of people that were very eager and willing to take the vaccine. And so there was, you know, like you said, you're hunting around for it. I know I heard a number of stories of people who wanted the vaccine and wanted to get it. I think the big issue was that the Hogan administration really had to push to get more vaccine from the federal government and try to find more vaccine. Unfortunately, they were successful in doing that, but it's I know that they've been pretty busy over at the Civic Center, and they're getting plenty of people coming in who want the vaccine. So I think Maryland has done a good job in catching up. There's that initial difficulty at the beginning, I think more related to the ability to procure the vaccine as opposed to people who wanted to take it.
Do you think there's been some disparity between, say, rural areas like ourselves and, say, major cities, which I suppose it's a certain obvious quality to, in the sense that big cities obviously have larger populations, sometimes more vulnerable as opposed to ourselves?
Well, we certainly have plenty of medical disparity here. You know, the three lower counties on the shore are, you know, some of the poorest in the state, and there's a tremendous lack of medical resources here. And so I think it's one of the reasons that the governor put one of the mass vaccination clinics out here, was because, you know, I think it's much more likely. I mean, the example I use, and I don't know, I have no idea if this is why he did it, but it's much more likely that somebody from Montgomery County is going to get in the car and drive down here to get a vaccine than somebody from Somerset County is going to drive to Montgomery County. And so he put that vaccine center down here, I think, to try to address the disparities in the rural population to be sure that people down here had the opportunity to get that vaccine. And he has one, you know, in inner city Baltimore at M&T Bank Stadium for, you know, a very similar reason. Get people in those neighborhoods down there, if they make that vaccine available to people who traditionally have been poorly and underserved.
Because I know, as a matter of fact, I ran into somebody down at the center here in Salisbury, and they had actually all come from Annapolis in order to get the vaccine. Apparently, they had problems there.
Yeah, and I think that just goes back to, I mean, Annapolis, again, you're talking about a very affluent area. People who have means, they're going to be more likely to be able to get into a car and drive 90 minutes to get the vaccine than people in poor rural counties are.
Yeah. So at this point, how are you feeling in terms of moving forward here? Do you think we're going to be out of this anytime soon? Or is normality going to come back anytime soon? Are we going to be going to restaurants? What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to think so. I think, you know, you're always going to have people. I think this is sort of also shined a light on the fact that, you know, the way we were sort of blithely doing things before, where everybody just sort of gathered in large places. I mean, there's always been communicable diseases, and we sort of took for granted the fact that most people just didn't have a vulnerability to them. So we always have to keep in mind that vulnerability exists. But I think the summer is going to be more normal, back to normal of sort of the summer of 2019, than the summer of 2020.
When do you think things might be sort of normal in the sense of, I mean, do you think about it still about 6 months away, or what do you think?
Yeah, I would think by the end of summer. Would certainly by the fall, I think things will be much more wide open.
And I suppose then the kids will be able to go back to school, you think? Classrooms?
You know, I
don't know if you've heard or not.
I would think so. I haven't heard anything. You know, I finally got to that point. I don't have kids in the local public schools. I think the universities are planning, you know, to be full bore ahead in the fall. I haven't heard anything about continued shutdowns. I think there's going to be opportunities or options for online coursework, but I think they are really trying to get people back in the classroom, certainly at the college level.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. Mike Murphy. He is an emergency room physician at Tidal Health Peninsula, and we appreciate you taking the time to talk with us this morning.
My pleasure, Don. Anytime.
This has been Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush. Thanks for listening.